Welcome to the UCSF Sports Medicine Podcast, 6 to 8 weeks, Perspectives in Medicine. During our program, we continue to cover a variety of hot topics in the sports medicine world and more.
Thank you, everyone, for joining our UCSF Sports Medicine Podcast, 6 to 8 weeks. I'm Dr. Nirav Bundia, and today we have the pleasure of having Pablo Torre on from Meadowlark Media and ESPN. A lot of us here in the Bay Area are huge fans of Pablo's work. So once again, thank you for joining our podcast. Really appreciate it.
Look, as the son of two doctors, I'm doing something dangerous here, which is I'm showing my parents that I'm still sort of thinking about the world of medicine. And I've been convincing them, trying to, that I'm a sports writer now, but I appreciate the invite and the danger involved here.
Anything we can do to make your parents happy. As a son of immigrant parents who all they wanted me to be was a doctor growing up, and I dabbled in saying, look, I want to be a track coach. And they're like, no, you're not going to be a track coach. So I understand yes. Where you're coming from. So first question, just for our audience, I always think it's important to know kind of how people got on the path they did. Kind of tell us a little bit more about how this path to being in sports media and sports journalism started for you.
I was supposed to be a lawyer, I guess. Again, son of two doctors, son of immigrants from the Philippines. I was the first one born in my family in America. And so for me, just having some sort of structural pathway towards a graduate degree and a job that was respectable and premised on academic rigor was always going to be sort of my thing. And a lawyer, it was sort of like, okay, well, you get to make some money and you get a credential and you purportedly get to use your interest in the humanities to write. And that's always been a lie. Let's be real about the lawyering. But the point is, I was supposed to go do that. And the entire time in college, I was also writing sports for the school newspaper. I went to Harvard, wrote for the Crimson, covered Jeremy Lin, covered Ryan Fitzpatrick, covered field hockey, all these random sports. And that was always a thing that I was doing for fun. And a brief capsule summary of what happened to me is I spent an entire year studying for the LSAT, took the test, had what I deem now in retrospect as something of a panic attack, and had a terrible score by my standards, which are cruel and unusual by normal people's standards, but was not good enough. And I realized that I got to like figure out what I'm going to do here. And so what I did was I took a job at Sports Illustrated as a fact checker, bottom of the rung, bottom of the ladder at the bottom rung. And I spent the summer before taking that. That was before junior year. This is now senior year. I spent the summer studying to take the LSAT again. And so I took the LSAT a second time. The next day or the next Monday after that, I started at Sports Illustrated. In sports media, I remain. My LSAT score the second time was, I have to say this to people who are respectable academic professionals, I did better, but I loved the actual thing I've been doing for fun the whole time. And so my score expired. I'm at SI. I get hired by ESPN later on. I found myself truly because of a failure doing this job that I consider just the greatest blessing because I never would have charted it this way.
How did you mention your parents? How did your parents kind of support you or kind of see this path as you're kind of going through the law school and then Sports Illustrated starting out there?
I think they were both very confused and also encouraging because they believed in me on a very, they're good parents. I want to make that clear. I make fun of them a lot because they're still sort of asking like, hey, you're going to go to like, how about business school? Because for them still like the academic grad school credential is understandably meaningful. They were worried, you know, like starting off as a fact checker at a magazine. As time goes on and we see the evolution of media, right? Like magazines begin to fall away. And I was always starting again at the bottom of the ladder. And so it was sort of like, where is this going? What do you want to do here? It kind of felt like my version, a safer version of like a kid who tells their parents, I want to be a stand-up comedian. And they're like, why is that a job? Are you good at this? I think they were confident that like, okay, we know this kid, our son, likes writing. And I did like debate in high school and stuff. And so when I started getting plugged into television, things began to turn, I think, because they sort of realized, oh, wow, this is like a real thing. My dad's a sports fan. My mom isn't. And so just these little sort of indicators, these heuristics that suggest this is going well, that really did make a bit of a dent in terms of their terror about like this son that we just sent to Harvard. He wants to go do what now? But the whole time, I should say, their reinforcement, and this is the immigrant story, right? Their reinforcement of hard work and just like the grind of what it takes That never went away. Like that, I just applied that to sports writing and to sports television and then to podcasting. So they are responsible for all of this. It's just that it's not in the way that they had ever dreamed when they came to America.
Do you find that, you know, for a lot of people who are entering in sports media, they're kind of starting at the bottom rung and then working your way up? Or do you see a lot more people trying to be that attention grabber from the beginning? Like, where do you see that progressing over the next couple of years?
Yeah. I mean, look, you're on Twitter. You see it. It's the economy's changed. The incentives of the economy have changed. The places where you'd go, like the ladders that I'm referring to, don't exist anymore. Like Sports Illustrated truly is like a zombie company at this point. And there's a lot more Googling we can all do if you want to just fall down that rabbit hole. But the point being that the idea of start off entry-level job, work your way up with an internship or otherwise has just changed. And so part of the promise, of course, of like of the internet, of social media, of the democratizing of all journalism, of all media communication, is that certainly people have access to microphones in ways that certainly when I was growing up, and I grew up, I was born in 85, that was never a thing. But the trade-off is that I was trained by truly like a masthead of professionals who I admired. And that sort of mentorship of, I don't know what my voice is. Let me learn what my voice is by fact-checking the greatest writers in sports journalism. Let me get my training by looking at them, trying to imitate them, being embarrassed in retrospect by how much I tried to imitate them, but sort of working within this system. I emerged from the sort of Wild West of internet democracy, yearning for an institution like the one that I had to raise me in a way that I am ever more grateful.
I think along with that, as you mentioned, kind of like the way that media is kind of out there with the Twitter and you know, the YouTube, kind of long form pieces just seem to have disappeared. And one of the pieces that I loved reading of yours was a Stephen Curry article where he talked about his surgery, his rehab, which I show to my patients all the time. Like, this isn't about a quick fix. There's a lot more that goes into it.
Right.
Where did your idea come to kind of explore this project with him and kind of chronicle his recovery from his ankle injuries?
Yeah. So my job at ESPN, the magazine, I got hired there as a senior writer. I had an editor, Ty Wenger, who would basically bring me the name of an athlete that was of some sort of note, an NBA player typically. And he'd say, like, can you do something with this? And in the case of Steph, the story that I had always been obsessed with was how we almost never got this version of him. And in fact, the story that I began to report and that became obvious to me was that the reason why he was so great in the present tense was because we almost never got this version of him. So the existential dread of Steph Curry's ankles being fundamentally cursed, like, what did that mean from a sports medicine, sports science perspective? Like, how bad was it into how did he try to address and get those problems fixed? And so for me, really, like, the light bulb going off was when I was on the phone with Dr. Richard Ferkel, I believe, was the man who did his surgery. Again, I refer to that sort of like immigrant hard work mentality. Like, what's something I do with all of my interviews typically is I am just over preparing. And so I just knew a lot when I think Richard Ferkel was probably thinking, like, who is this stalker that I have? But I came to him with all of these sort of like very specific questions. And what we ended up having was a, pardon the pun here, but a reconstruction of the night or of the surgery when Steph Curry goes under and they have to go in. And Dr. Richard Ferkel points out, like, he sees the crab meat, you know, the stuff in his body. That's just like, okay, the scar tissue. He gave me a level of detail that allowed me to reconstruct that scene. And I was like, okay, so if I can bring the reader in to the moment at which not just Steph Curry, but also NBA history changed, then I can sort of continue to reconstruct. What do you do from there? And so Steph Curry, I had heard Tom Haberstroh, a colleague of mine, had reported this amazing detail previously where Steph Curry could like deadlift like 400 pounds. And it was like, how is that possible? And you realize that part, and I interviewed KK Lyles, who was the Warriors director of like sports science performance stuff. I spent a whole day with him, with KK, and he pointed out, like, look, the glutes, the hips, like the ways that Steph fixed himself, it wasn't just let's focus on the ankles. It was the whole kinetic chain of his body, they renovated and made stronger to the point where Steph is now just one of the strongest players in the NBA when it comes to like body weight and any sort of weightlifting metric. So for me, it was just telling the story of how did this guy become a thing that we still underestimate? And it's because, in fact, his career was almost over. I mean, he was plagued by the fact that his ankles would just break in like non-contact ways all of the time. And now he's reliably just one of the strongest specimens we have in sports.
I think people forget that part of his career now as we kind of, you know, reach the quote unquote, the tail end of his career is like what, how injured he was and all those battles that he had before. So absolutely. Yeah. And in the preparation, I always that fine balance of there's all this great medical information, all this knowledge, and then there's the reader. How do you find the right balance of giving enough, but not getting stuck into detailed descriptions of surgeries?
I think about that, especially now as a podcaster, because my instinct, of course, as I say, to over report, have all of this detail, and then you sort of kill your darlings, as they say in the world of writing, where even the little things that you love that you know are meaningful, if it's not going to stick with the listener or with the reader, you lose it. And so to me, I'm always writing for a general audience. I'm always writing with truly the motive of, I believe that every reader or listener is looking for an exit ramp. And if I use just one syllable too many because I wanted to show off that I knew this word to my, so my parents can recognize that I'm like familiar with this term, or the surgeon I interviewed is familiar, I'm actually counterproductively doing my job. And so I always try to make it so that someone who knows nothing about Steph Curry, let alone surgery or medicine, can be engaged in this. And so, yeah, you sort of, again, hard taught to use surgical terminology here, but yeah, you sort of, you pare it down, you shave down, you reconstruct, and you hopefully the patient lives, you know? And with this story, thankfully, people were into the story. And I think, by the way, last thing, as I ramble on about like, how do you build a story? Never forget you're telling a story. And if people are not taking away from that story what you intended in terms of like how you structured it and how you architected it, truly like the building of it, then you're sort of, I think, misunderstanding the assignment.
No, I know. I totally agree. I mean, I had the pleasure one time Baxter Holmes came and watched me operate for a sports specialization story. And I'm just doing the surgery, whatever. And then the way he wrote it, you know, I sent it to my mom. I'm like, this is what I do. It sound, made this sound so elegant. So it is amazing how you, all of you writers do it. And it's like, there are details that you're describing that really makes what we're doing sound really beautiful. So it is an amazing thing.
But hold on though, because I think there's also something that's gained when you, and I try to do this too always, is pretend, as I say, write for general audience, pretend you're an outsider. And so I am 100% confident, and Baxter's a tremendous writer, that if you were to bring an alien into the room where you do surgery, they would notice things that you probably are numb to. And so for me, with talking to a guy like Dr. Ferkel, I was like, so wait a minute. So this guy could wake up and he'd have a cadaver's body part in his leg. Like that, like I assume on some level, that's just like, yeah, that's, we do that. Like if right. you need to do it. But I'm like, well, we can phrase that in a way that communicates Steph Curry might wake up with a dead man's tendons.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's how you, and that's the hook. Right. Like, so anyway, it's just fascinating if you're not the person doing the job often to then look at stuff that people take for granted.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, within this line of kind of medicine and sports medicine that's kind of creeping into media more, where do you see this going in the future? Because one of the things that I see a lot more, there's people who kind of two schools of thought. There's people who want the stories and there are people who want this information for Vegas reasons.
Yeah.
Do you see that there's going to be more of a transition to people just wanting injury information for that? Or is there really a desire to learn sports science amongst readers?
My hope is that, first of all, the Vegas aspect is objectively the direction where the money is flowing. And so that, in terms of like what's feeding journalism, what's feeding media, we're getting towards, I would say, actionable betting information being considered ever more valuable. And so that's going to lead in terms of just the economics of this. And 100%, there will be a need for people to translate and explain, like, so wait a minute, how many weeks out is this guy? I mean, great name for your show, right? Like how, like you want to know the brass tacks of this, which is often, of course, highly individualized and unpredictable, but best left to experts to sort of estimate as best they can versus just like people who don't know anything about medicine. Now, my instinct though, is that as we go in that direction, there will be a market and an audience for people who actually want to understand this as not a betting algorithm, but just a person. And I think for me, what I am bullish on, what I believe to be underestimated, is just the desire that people still have for stories. and reported stories, fact-checked stories, journalistic stories in particular. I mean, I often find myself like having to make the argument, and I've made several of them already just in the short time with you about like what the institution of journalism, both in a literal magazine sense, but also just as a concept, what that really entails and why that's meaningful. My hope and my bet is that even if the economy is going in the direction of betting, that we still will have people, because it's just an eternal human instinct to want someone to explain it. So when you say sports science, I just think at a certain point, if you're hearing all the time about injuries, there will be a far more than non-zero number of people who will ask, so what does this mean? Not from the betting implication perspective, but from the human perspective, from the like, how does this all work perspective? And that's hopefully where I continue to come in as I try to keep my job in the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it is interesting that as we become more and more Twitter, you know, tweet based or kind of, you know, shock based, that if you keep seeing these things, eventually you're like, what does this all mean? What does it all mean for the individual? So I think it is this balance of getting likes versus actually there's something behind all this stuff. So it is an interesting kind of way we're going.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, by the way, depth, because everything is on demand and personalized to your algorithmic recommendation and all of that, I also think that people still, and this is the premise of a magazine in my show, right? So my show is Pablo Torre Finds Out. What I'm really doing is quietly just building a magazine that exists in audio and video. And what I do is I try to surprise people with topics that they are interested in, but they don't quite know it yet. And I think the bet fundamentally is just on curiosity and discovery. And that was always what I was into. It's like, okay, do you trust this person to tell you a story? Great. Okay. What if it's a story you didn't know that you wanted to hear about? Like you didn't Google it, but it's somewhere out there because you saw this other headline. Because anyway, I won't belabor the whole point here, but I think discovery on the internet in the age of high-speed communication is still something that people want. It's just not the most obvious way to make money when the algorithm is incentivizing other things.
Kind of hand in hand with that is like who are the people who are telling these stories? And, you know, one of the things that, just like in medicine and all other fields, as the people who are more publicly facing become more diverse, there almost seems to be a backlash a little bit to that. I'm sure you are very familiar with that. Where do you kind of feel that going? Because I think that we have more diverse people telling stories, but whenever that diverse person tells a story, they're like, oh, you didn't play football. You don't look like who I expect to be telling this story. How have you navigated that, you know, which seems to be more present now where you've got all the social media feedback where you see it in front of you?
Yeah, it's funny. So when I was on ESPN, I started doing ESPN television in 2012. So a dozen years ago, almost. And immediately, of course, the reaction I got was like, who is this guy? Like this Asian dude with a Mexican name, as often was tweeted. I'm Filipino. That's actually a pretty good summary in some ways. But the point is, people were like, this guy obviously wasn't a professional athlete. And yeah, my sport in high school was high school varsity debate. So guilty, right? Guilty on all these charges. And so I always took that though as like, that's my niche then. Like, I'm not going to be the athlete. My takes are not going to be about like, they're not going to be those that many pro athletes are very good at this job in ways that are beyond just like pro athlete telling other pro athlete what to do. But I'm not going to be a pro athlete telling a pro athlete what to do. I'm going to have another angle that is based. So early on, it was like, okay, so the analytics movement was sort of in beginning to bloom. I was like, I need to familiarize myself with that. Let me go to the empirical side of like argumentation. Let me go to data. And then it became more of, for me, I was like, if my perspective is that of an informed critic of sports who brings in a journalistic background and can make connections to all sorts of other things, whether it's economics or medicine, it's almost like this liberal arts approach to like sports commentary, then that's what I'm going to do. But fundamentally for everybody else, just understand that like if you are going to come into a culture as an outsider, and again, there are immigrant sort of like vibes throughout this entire thing. But if you're going to come as an outsider, just know that like, yeah, you're not, don't expect to be welcomed in. Expect bigotry, actually. Expect people to doubt you. And certainly when I was at ESPN early on, I'd tell people when I was just starting out, you know, who worked in sports. And I'd be like, yeah, I work at ESPN. And I'd be asked, oh, you do tech support. And it's just like, no, I talk about actual sports, like I'm on television and stuff. And so there's always that part. which all of us are familiar with in some regard. But the next step, I think, is, look, if you ever want reassurance, just like understand, like, we have people covering the presidency who have never been president. Our political class, and I'm not saying that it's perfect, but I'm just saying that, like, there are more examples of people who have not done the job that they are covering than there are the other way. And sports is just interesting and perhaps its own sui generis thing, because we believe it to be almost like, let's be honest, like, sports can feel like Hogwarts sometimes when it's like, only a wizard can. It's like, no, like, we can, normal fans can see what's happening. It's just a matter of what is your credibility and how is that conveyed and how do you define it? And so for me, I think it's just having a sense of your identity. Like, what are you here to do? What do you do well? Don't pretend like you're something that you're not, but then own the things that you're good at, because if you have a niche, then by definition, you are doing something that other people aren't.
Exactly. No, I think eventually people, as you obviously know well more than me, is that if you're providing, you're giving thoughtful analysis, you're showing that this is something that you're interested in and you're producing, 99% of people are going to love it and take you for it. And then there's that 1-2% who are like, oh, well, you didn't do this. Eventually, you just have to be like, look, I'm still ignore it, but I'm going to keep pushing.
Yeah. And I should say, like, a numbness is required here. Yeah. Like, this is any sort of job that's public facing, especially when you're an outsider, it becomes a thing where, like, my nerve endings have kind of been burnt off to my mentions. You know, like, I just don't feel it in the same way. It's an unhuman thing to say your nerve endings have been burned off by internet commentary. But by and large, I am happy, but also a little concerned to say that that's mostly true. And if you don't have that capacity, I have friends, colleagues who, for whom they still live and die with that stuff. And it's really hard for them. And that's also because they're human.
Now, our last question, we don't want to take up too much of your time. If you're sitting on the weekend, who are you reading? Who are you listening to as a fan, as a regular human being that doesn't work for ESPN or Meadowlark? Who are you turning to?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm doing is trying to go to the people who do the things that I don't. So on the NFL, Mina Kimes, my good friend, Dominique Foxworth, my good friend, like, people who are grinding tape in a real way. Like, I'm trying to outsource the jobs that I don't do to people that I trust so that they can just download their brains into mine. So I do stuff like that. Tom Haberstroh, who I mentioned before, on the NBA, he has a great newsletter, Tom the Finder. I download his stuff into my brain. Beyond that, in terms of, like, how my diet of consumption is formed, I'm both trying to, because I do Around the Horn, I do PTI, I'm doing, like, daily sports television programming, so I got to be always fluent in the games. And I also still, like, it's a ridiculous joy and privilege to have the games be a huge chunk of my job. But then the rest of it really is, like, how can I make connections to things beyond sports, to sports? And that part, which is where my show and my brain is mostly occupied now. It's like, it's that magazine of, like, if I can bring you a story about, I'll just use as an example, but we have a story upcoming that'll connect to politics. And I'm like, okay, well, how can I make it so that somebody who's not interested in politics, but is interested in sports or vice versa, might want this thing, might not get on the exit ramp. And for that, I find that I'm oftentimes tumbling deep into rabbit holes that have nothing to do with daily sports programming. And so my brain is a bit schizophrenic in that way. I am always trying to be mindful of the news and the tape grinders and what I can learn. And I'm also trying to go far beyond that to do the thing that few people are doing in our industry. And so, yeah, it's fun, man. It's fun. And it's not being a lawyer, I should say.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining our podcast, Pablo. Really appreciate it. Lots of fans out here in the Bay Area and nationally, and really enjoy your work. So thanks for taking the time for joining us, and look forward to seeing you on TV and radio, man.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you for the thoughtful questions. As a researcher, I appreciate the work you put into this too.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Pablo. Appreciate it. Yep.
Thanks for listening to the UCSF Sports Medicine Podcast, 6 to 8 Weeks, Perspectives in Medicine. What do you think of this topic? Connect with us now. In addition to finding our contact form, you'll also find our social media links in our entire 6 to 8 Weeks episode archive. Help us grow our listenership by liking, subscribing, and sharing everywhere. We're eager to hear from you, and we'll be sending you more great thought-provoking content in less than 6 to 8 weeks.